Good morning. As chairman of the Symposium on Cross-Cultural Education, it's my pleasure to open this morning's session and to introduce to you the members of the symposium, all of whom I hope you'll have a very ample opportunity to get acquainted with and to discuss this issue with during the course of the morning. On my immediate left, Dr. Robert Raff of the Northwest Educational Research Laboratory in Portland, director of the cultural programs there, intercultural programs, and very active in Alaskan educational problems at the present time. On his immediate left, Dr. Kenneth Fleshman of the U.S. Public Health Service, working out of the Anchorage office. And on his left, Dr. Charles Ray, Professor of Education at the University of Alaska, and former teacher in the schools in the bush, as well as a very recent student of cross-cultural education while on a year's sabbatical leave touring many nations of the world investigating this problem at those levels. On my immediate right is Mr. James Hawkins, presently Deputy Secretary of, or Assistant Secretary in the Department of Commerce, but probably better known to most of you as a former Alaskan Director of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, School Superintendent at Nanilchik and Dillingham, and Director of the Rural Development Agency in the early days of, late days of territorial or early state, someplace in that neighborhood. And Mr. Hawkins presently, or most recently, has come from tour as director of the educational programs for the trust territories in the Pacific. On his right, Professor James Orvik, social psychologist with the Department of Education, doing research in the nature of teachers, teacher characteristics, and the and the work related to the improvement of rural school programs in Alaska through psychological approaches. And on his immediate right, Dr. William Davis, professor of psychology from Alaska Methodist University, director of some of their programs for the improvement of rural schools, including the Upward Bound program that they've had there, and presently in involved in concerned about research in the educational problems. Former president of the Alaska Division of AAS and chairman of two Alaska Science conferences. I'd like to make one or two introductory remarks, then we'll get on to the procedure for the morning. The symposium members are going to highlight papers that they have prepared, each addressed to their topic, after which we will call for questions from the audience. Probably this will take us up to the coffee hour break. Thus, I'm going to request that all questions come in written form so that we might achieve some balance to the second portion of the symposium. We would like for all of the issues that may be generated through the presentation of papers to have the chance to be aired. And thus, if you do have a question that comes up during the course of the presentation, the highlighting of the papers, would be appreciated if you would make a note of this and turn this in to me or leave it here at the table during the coffee break, after which time we will have these questions addressed to whomever it is that you find the issue or concern that you would like to inquire about. Education, in the narrowest sense, may be looked upon as a process of enculturation. I think this is the type of education that most of us grew up in, the system of education that we consider home to us. Much has been written about this in recent years in both popular magazines and professional journals, learning theories, the methods and technology of education. However, in Alaska and other areas in the North and many other areas in the world, there is an attendant or a supplemental type of educational problem that presents a much more complex issue. The process of acculturation, or that of transfer of cultural diffusion, or the exchange of cultural styles from one group of people to another, becomes a much more complex educational process. Not only is a person involved in learning the ways of his own culture, but he is also involved in the process of learning an alien, or certainly a culture that is contrary in some respects to that that he finds from his enculturation process. This essentially is the issue of cross-culturalism. Certainly it's the issue of cross-culturalism in Alaska, where we have groups of people that are really no longer content or satisfied with all of the aspects of the culture in which they have been born, but they are unable to compete in the culture that seems to encroach upon their own culture. They're unable to compete economically or socially because of a lack of knowledge of the cultural ways in this dominant culture coming about them. Thus, cross-culturalism presents far more problems to the already problem-ridden processes of education. It's to this subject that all of the papers presented this morning address themselves in one form or another. We'll hear first, and it's certainly the most logical place to begin this discussion, we'll hear first on the health problems as they relate to the educational process in the Alaskan bush from Dr. Fleshman.
Thank you. Most children in the U.S. enter school life as apparently well youngsters who present no special problems in achieving their educational potential. Yet approximately 15% do present educational problems which involve consideration of physical, mental, or social health. The Alaska Native children have suffered an excessive amount of illness and enter school with a significantly higher degree of handicaps that will interfere with learning. These children will require special consideration to reach their full educational potential. The infant mortality, that is, the deaths in the first year of life, is currently more than two times greater than that in the rest of the United States. This is a great improvement from the past. In 1950, nearly one out of 10 infants born alive died before his first birthday. In addition, this mortality continued through the preschool years, so that it was not uncommon for families in Western Alaska to raise only 2 out of 10 children to school age. We believe that this high mortality had a definite effect on the survivors in that the parents were unable emotionally to properly nurture these children, and survival certainly took precedence over aspiration for formal education. Very fortunately, this mortality has been significantly reduced, and the survival of preschoolers is essentially assured. There are two types of deleterious effects of illness in children. The first directly related to the physical effects of the disease, and the second nonspecific and related to factors such as separation from parents and prolonged hospitalization. Studies in metropolitan areas have repeatedly shown the significant and prolonged emotional problems that can be induced by a hospitalization for such brief a time as for a tonsillectomy. If this is a concern in caring for the average U.S. child, consider the plight of the native child who may become ill in a village, taken to the field hospital by someone other than his parent, perhaps transferred to the referral hospital 400 to 600 miles away, stay 1 to 3 months, return home again to his village, often escorted by a stranger. It is not hard to imagine that even though the child recovers physically, significant emotional problems may occur. A child so affected may experience serious learning, school and learning problems. The direct residual effects of early childhood disease are particularly relevant in our discussion of learning ability. Mental retardation. Good quantitative surveys of mental retardation in the native population are lacking, but it is safe to say that even the smallest rural school will have at least one retarded child. The real tragedy is that 1/3 of the definitely identified retarded children were normal at birth, but have suffered brain damage due to infectious diseases early in infancy. Genetic diseases such as PKU have not been identified. Visual defects. There's been a marked decline in serious visual defects with the effective control of tuberculosis. During the height of the TB epidemic, many children suffered permanent scarring of the cornea due to flectanular keratoconjunctivitis, or PKC. This is a hypersensitivity reaction to the tubercle bacillus. Refractive errors are common, but our ophthalmologists are usually able to get to these children before this defect interferes seriously with their education. Nutrition. Very frightening information has recently come from South and Central America, where workers have shown the permanent effects of malnutrition in infancy. They've shown that protein deprivation in early infancy leads to smaller and fewer cells in the central nervous system and permanent measurable decrease in mental ability. Fortunately, at the present time, the infant diet in Alaska is adequate in protein, although deficient in certain other nutrients such as iron. The diets of nursing mothers, however, are documented to be below acceptable minimums of the U.S. We are seeing a deterioration in the general diet with a change from subsistence to purchased food and must be constantly alert for deleterious effects on health. The diets of school-aged children are definitely not adequate, and in many villages, over 50% of the daily nutritional needs are supplied by the school lunch. Hearing loss. The most significant physical handicap facing the native child is hearing loss. Again, this disease is not congenital, but is due to ear infections acquired in an environment conducive to the increased incidence and a less favorable outcome. Acute otitis media is an infection of the middle ear in which there is a collection of pus causing pain and usually fever. It actually is a relatively common occurrence in all children, but responds to medical treatment and hearing remains normal. In the native child, the acute attacks are much more frequent, 50% more in Eskimo children than children living in Wasilla, and are often not treated and lead rapidly to perforation of the eardrum. If this process is not treated early or recurs frequently, it becomes chronic and the hearing loss increases as the eardrum is destroyed and the delicate ossicular chain is eroded. At this stage, simple medical management can no longer return things to normal. The handicap that results depends on the age of occurrence, the severity, and whether one or both ears are involved. 90% of the Eskimo children who will ever develop otitis media develop it by age 2. These attacks are accompanied by fluctuating hearing loss during the years of most rapid language development. It has now been definitely documented that children so affected will, when tested at school age, show a significant delay in all language schools requiring the receiving and processing of auditory stimuli or the production of verbal responses. It is doubtful, but not known, whether or not this delay can ever be corrected. The degree of hearing loss we are considering is conductive in type and generally between 20 and 40 decibels. The child will appear to hear normal conversation in that he demonstrates awareness of speech. However, in a less favorable auditory environment, such as the usual classroom, he will not understand much of what is being said. What is the magnitude of this most serious problem in communication? All studies to date indicate that 1/3 of the native children suffer an episode of draining ears in the first year of life. With approximately 2,000 births per year, we're talking about 660 new cases annually. About 60% of these can be expected to have recurrent episodes. By the time they enter school, much of the disease has become quiescent, and approximately 10% or 200 per year will have residually perforated eardrums. If this rate is constant throughout Alaska, it would mean that 2,500 school-aged children have a damaged ear, and 625 of these are affected bilaterally and represent critical problems in education. We have no knowledge of the degree of language delay suffered by those whose ears at school age appear healed. A cohort of infants studied since birth and providing much of the above information had audiometric testing done at 4 years of age. Of 378 children in the Bethel area, 22% had a hearing loss greater than 40 decibels. An additional 10% had a loss between 25 and 40. In January of this year, the otology program of the Public Health Service was directed toward the Bethel School. Audiologic screening was given to all 770 students. 50% failed screening. Many of these losses were in the frequency above the normal speech range and possibly due to acoustic trauma from guns. 20%, however, had a hearing loss in the speech frequencies in at least one ear of greater than 25 decibels, and as previously stated, would be expected to encounter difficulty in the classroom. 17%, or 123 of these students, required some specialized medical or surgical procedure in an attempt to restore hearing. Psychometric testing was done on all 123 children needing otologic services. 20 of these children were in special ed, and the remaining 103 were in the regular classroom. Of these, 65 were one or more years behind in grade placement. There was a total loss of 120 school years. The test results showed a performance IQ of 96. The verbal IQ was 73. This work was finished in June, and the children are now under surveillance to determine the success rate of the surgery in both restoring hearing and improving their academic function. These results will guide future efforts in other areas of Alaska. It's apparent that the average Native child enters school with a history of more illness and a greater likelihood of permanent residual disability. Whereas surveys of school populations in metropolitan areas show a hearing loss of between 2.5% and 4% of the children, in rural Alaska, 20% of the Native children demonstrate a severe loss. Intensified efforts by the Alaska Department of Health and the U.S. Public Health Service will be identifying these children and providing maximal rehabilitative treatment. This will by no means correct all of the hearing problems nor the communication disability. With one-fifth of a classroom affected, a standard curriculum simply will not do. Along with recognition of the problem, preferential seating and amplification, a remedial problem to enhance verbal ability must be developed. Special education programs outside of the village should not be relied upon, since further separation from their home and family will only aggravate the frequently coexistent emotional and social problems. I've emphasized physical health problems. This is not to deny the existence of serious emotional and social problems affecting these Native children. With each improvement in the delivery of health care and sanitation and in housing, there is an improvement in physical health. However, as Dr. Martha Wilson has already discussed, the pressures of a changing culture and urbanization are severe stresses to which many families and children are reacting adversely.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Fleshman. We'll next hear from Dr. Robert Raff, the cultural relevance of existing curricula in schools for Alaska Native pupils.
I'll use my school teacher's voice. Can you hear me, Bob? All right. I want to show some pictures. So excuse me a minute while we plug in. Or recommendations. condition that I would like to present rather than rationale background. You may wish to question me on the rationale. So really what I'm talking about are a series of recommendations that I come to at the end of the paper. Let me talk about each one very briefly and illustrate only one of them. First, it seems to me that Alaskan education should be both regionalized in Alaska and decentralized within Alaska. This is the only way to get at what I consider to be a major problem, closing the gulf between the school and the community. It's a good research rationale for this kind of statement. In doing this, I see a differentiation of a whole series of kinds of functions, administration, control, getting it as close as possible to that community. Is that wrong? If we want to talk about control of education, closing this gap, we have to talk about hiring teachers, budgets, and policies as they occur in that school. I see integral to this the need for a large category of Native Alaskans present in the classrooms in a variety of roles. As teacher, yes, but there are also a whole series of teaching functions that can and should be performed by village personnel. Seems to me also that the school, as I perceive it, is largely an embodiment of child-rearing from an outside society. A part of what must occur, as I see it, is a amelioration of the school child-rearing pattern and its home child-rearing pattern. I use the term amelioration, not acculturation or any of these kinds of things. For this reason, I think there's a tremendous amount that could be done in early childhood education, as well as education of the mothers who rear children. When I hear 10 statements of the health problems, I don't know to what extent some of these might be alleviated through a change in certain minimal child-rearing practices. Seems to me clearly that secondary education for Alaskan students is primarily and at the decision of the family, and as to being in Alaska. So it seems to me that it should be going back here. When I talk about the curriculum within a school, we want to talk, I see little or nothing wrong with the current list of courses. I see nothing wrong with language arts, science, and social studies, and music art. This is, to me, a very vital list. With two omissions, in my opinion. One is the notion of occupational education, not vocational education, but occupational education. Here the notion is that every student beginning at 5th grade 7 should be exposed to occupations in a career ladder sense, so that at the time he leaves grade 12, he is fully qualified to enter into some post-high school training, including college and university. He has knowledge of one or more career ladders. He also has an entry-level skill whereby he can earn the money to go to college if that is needed. Seems to me that this must begin by about grade 7. There's some real exciting work that has been done for Canada and the United States along this line. Fourth recommendation David, we have to begin to develop teachers in Alaska, not in Florida, to Alaska. So Native adults should be major figures in classrooms. There are a whole series of functions these people could perform, not just the clerk. In my opinion, they can perform instructional tasks. A fifth recommendation, it seems to me, must reside around the social set. And again, it's a qualification. It seems to me that the social studies for Alaska's classroom should go through a period of development, very carefully keeping them intellectually honest, drawing the discipline in terms of generalization and modes of inquiry from those disciplines, but focus at Alaska and in the lower grades, the immediate community. It must be kept intellectually honest, in my opinion. Seems to me we have to look at several sources of expertise to do this, not only within the social sciences, but the physical sciences, to make understanding how it can distribution of people, as well as the interrelationships of people, both in Alaska and other people that have met similar circumstances. The other major curriculum omission that I see is partially hit by this notion of social studies. This is the place where you can begin to be then an intellectually honest man. The history and culture of the people here, not just natives, but also whites. What happens to them? The other area that should be in, and I know of no effort in this way, is the development of the native language as an option